Hi, my name's June. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I didn't set my watch, so I'm going to try to remember to stop at 9:30 your time rather than 9:30 my time, which would be 4 hours from now. I really want to thank the committee and all of you for inviting me to be part of this weekend. I appreciate that you'd invited me many times when I wasn't able to come, and that you continued to invite me. I am really thrilled that I was able to be here, and it was really nice to get to spend a little time with Susan and to share a little bit of her celebrating a dozen years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, and to get to see some old friends that I hadn't seen in a very long time, and to get to make some new ones, which is really what I think one of the things that I think are so special about conferences. And I love conferences, and I strongly encourage those of you who might be new in particular to try and find out some who is involved in the conference and try and get active in the committees so that you can get to more and more conferences, because I think that you'll meet some very active people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and those people who I've met through my service commitments have been some of the most valuable friendships examples that I've been privileged to know in the years that I've been sober. I spoke at a meeting a number of years ago now, and a man came up to me afterwards to thank me for my talk, mainly because his sponsor was standing behind him and made him do that, I'm sure. And he said to me, you know, he said, I really want to thank you for your story. He said, I don't really believe that was your story, but I liked the way that you told it. I thought about that ever since then, because it would only be that we would, you know, sit in Alcoholics Anonymous and be paranoid enough to think that someone might spend a lot of time making up a story so they could stand up here to tell it. You know. But really what amazed me about that story is that basically what this man was saying is that I didn't look like my story. And boy, that's an incredible tribute to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I want to assure you, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and joined this program, the 13th of July, 1972, which is my sobriety date, I looked like my story. And I looked like my story for a long time afterwards. You know, not too long ago, I was having lunch with Clancy and a bunch of people out in my neighborhood, and Clancy was talking to some other people about me, and he was saying that after he had known me for 4 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, he thought that I actually looked worse than when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's been a very slow recovery here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, no one ever asks me questions like this, but I sometimes think of things, you know, on my own, and I think if there was a reason why, if someone asked me what the reason I thought was that we lose so many people after 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, so many people that go back out or that don't stay after a couple of years of sobriety, I would have to say that I believe it's because the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works incredibly slowly. And I imagine that many of you who are here are people like me who want things to change now, right now. You know, just like Norm Alpey used to say, you know, he wanted that whiskey, he wanted to get town right now, you know. And that's sort of all the way that I've always been. And it's been amazing to me and frustrating and a number of other emotions sometimes where I see where I am and I think, I'm not where I should be. I'm not as far as I should be. Things should have happened faster than this. I must have missed a step. I must have missed a page. Something along those lines. And yet the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, it does happen. But we have to show up, you know, to make it happen. I was listening to a tape, and I listened to a lot of tapes. I have listened to more and more tapes the longer I've been sober. Listened to this guy, and he was talking on his tape. And he had longer than I had at the time. So, you know, I don't know. He had, you know, maybe 30-some years. And he said, you know, if I had to tell you the one thing, I mean, if I had to narrow down the fact that I have been able to stay sober for over 30 continuous years, if I really had to put it down to one thing, if I had to say there's one thing that has been the definitive reason why I've been able to maintain sobriety for over 30 years, just one thing, and I'm listening because I'm thinking, hey, in case I'm missing this, I want to make sure I've got it. He said, I would have to say that the one thing, the most important thing that I've done for over 30 continuous years, he said, it's been not drinking. And I think sometimes, you know, we forget those simple things, you know, have a lot to do with the beginning of this, you know. Anyway, I believe in the format that the Big Book suggests, which is that we share a little bit about what it was like, what happened, what it's like today, and so I'm going to go ahead and do that. Before I begin to talk, though, I know that there are some people who are fairly new here, and I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to encourage you to go to some other meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am not an expert or a spokesperson for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not an expert on alcoholism. I'm merely a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to stand up here for a little while and share with you, just as any other member in Alcoholics Anonymous would do. And there's just a couple things, you know, that I want to try and share before. And if you can at least listen for long enough to hear this, then I think you've heard the most important thing I'm going to say all night. And that is that many of us come into Alcoholics Anonymous in many, many different ways. I don't really believe it's important how we get here, once we get here. But because we do arrive in many different ways, I want to be very clear about the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely free. And that's very important to me, because I was over 10 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I could put a dollar in the basket. So this is not about money. This is not about having enough money to come or having enough money to stay. It's not what it's about. It's absolutely free. No one is paid to stand up and share in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's very important for a number of reasons. Because I want you to know that we're all just members the same, no matter who's up here talking. And also because after the meeting, I don't want you sitting around having ice cream saying, "You mean we had to pay her for that?" You know, so I just want you to know that that's not what it's all about. I'm one of those people that believes I was born an alcoholic. I do not want to have a philosophical discussion about that with anyone here after the meeting. It's just what I believe. I believe it because there was something wrong with me long before I ever started to drink. And many of you may not identify with my story, and yet I need to share my story because that's why I'm here and that's why each and every one of us is, you know. And so for me, I knew there was something wrong with me before I ever started to drink. And the way that first manifested itself in me, my first obsession in life was suicide. And from as far back as I can remember, before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, there were no days in my life where I didn't try and take my own life, pray to a God that I was slowly losing faith in to please let me die, or put myself in a position where someone else would be likely to take my life. And that's really, you know, what it was all about for me before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, when I look back on the years before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've tried to assess that honestly to see if it was just, you know, all those suicide attempts were just to get attention or, you know, to get my own way or things like that. I'm certain that some of them were. But yet I have to tell you that deep down to the very bottom of my heart, up to and including today, as I look back, before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, every single day in my life I wanted to die. I just wanted out. And for someone like me, I have to be extremely grateful that I was introduced to alcohol at 8 years old. By the time I found alcohol, I had already been using drugs for a year. By the time I was 9 years old, I found a combination that I never altered in any way, and that was barbiturates or downers or reds or yellows, whatever you might know them as, and alcohol. And the combined effect of those got me where I needed to go. I am not a party girl. I've never had a social drink in my life, nor have I ever wanted one. I don't have a very exciting drunkologue. If you drank the way that I did and you mixed it with those things, you don't either, you know. I just really wanted to die. I wasn't interested in trying to have a good time or to feel good. I never used alcohol in that way. I just wanted to not feel anything at all. And thank God it worked that way for me. Because I really believe I would have had to have been locked up in some kind of an institution because I couldn't make it out there. Life hurt way, way too much for me, always. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I knew a lot about alcoholism firsthand. I knew I was never going to be an alcoholic. I did not see alcoholism as a disease. I saw it as a weakness. And in my life, there was never anything that I was less tolerant of than those things that I was to decide were weaknesses. And I thought my mother was weak. And that was never going to happen to me. Now, when I was growing up, I'm an only child. I realize now that most of the people that I was looking at were also alcoholics. But I saw that men and women in my life handled the exact same situations, but in completely different ways. To the best of my recollection, before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I do not remember ever seeing a man cry under any circumstances. I've seen men shot. I've seen them stabbed. I've seen them arrested. I've seen their wives leave them. I've seen their kids overdose. I've seen a lot of different things. I never saw a man shed a tear. I saw the women in my life go through all of those same events. Some of them didn't cry, but most of them did at one point or another. And I looked at those two different groups of people, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent all my life before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and for quite a while afterwards, trying to be what I thought a man was. And to me, a man was someone who cared about no one, who felt absolutely nothing. And if they did, they never let anyone know it. And the only acceptable emotion, it seemed to me, as I looked at these two different groups, was anger and rage. That seemed to be all that men ever felt. And that was how I tried to live my life. Now, unfortunately for me, having set those standards for myself, I was to find out that I was one of those people that I've heard Clancy talk about that was born without any insulation for my emotions. So that from my earliest memories as I went out into the world, absolute strangers looking at me funny, let alone saying anything, could hurt my feelings. And so again, my earliest memories were that I found out I was the thing that I hated the most in the entire world. I was weak, and I never forgave myself for it. It was absolutely unacceptable to me that I was that way. But with the use of alcohol, I didn't have to face that at all. I didn't have to feel weak. I didn't have to care. I didn't, you know. And up till then, you know, when people tease me about being tall, being skinny, and having curly red hair, and, you know, what my family was like, and what my clothes were like, and, you know, all of that stuff, it bothered me. But once I had alcohol, it didn't matter. I didn't care about any of you, and I certainly didn't care about me. I just wanted to not wake up one day. And obviously, you know, that didn't happen. I grew up in a town in Los Angeles called Venice. It's a beach town. And when I was growing up, you know, I was raised in a pretty traditional Catholic family. And they'd say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, a boy. And that bothered my family a lot. It wasn't as easy to do back then as it is today. And they were really worried because I seemed pretty insistent about this idea. And they began taking me to priests and to talk to me about this idea that I had. And we were on welfare. And because of that, the priests found out that I could be seen by psychiatrists and psychologists. And I went to see these people. I don't have a diagnosis to give you about why they thought I tried to kill myself or why I hated myself so much or any of the other things that I've alluded to so far. I felt about psychiatrists and psychologists just like my friend Patty Hicks always did, you know, and that was, I thought they should work for their money, so I never told them anything. I didn't answer one question, I didn't fill out one form, I sat there, I didn't play with one toy, sat there the required period of time, and when it was over, I got up and I walked out. So I wasn't able to receive help from that area, you know. That's not to say that there might not have been some that could have been offered, but I was not willing or able to accept it. Somewhere along the line, I accepted for myself that I wasn't going to be able to be a boy. And so the only option, as I saw it, where I grew up, and as I saw the world, was to be a tough broad. And I spent all my time before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous trying to be what I thought a tough broad was. Now, in the years that I've been sober, I've traveled a lot, I've gotten to know a lot of people, a lot of other tough broads, and I have found that some tough broad standards are geographical, you know, and they can vary according to weather and area. Being that I lived in Los Angeles, which is a beach town, it was very important if you're going to be a tough broad that you have tough feet. And so you don't wear shoes. Shoes are just absolutely forbidden if you're going to be tough. And so I didn't wear shoes. It was important that you be in a gang, and I was. It was important that you do a lot of fighting, and I did. It's important that I remember to tell you tonight that I've never won a fight in my life. But I've never fought less than five people at a time. And my sponsor explained to me that the reason for that is if you fight one person and you lose, someone might think you're not a very good fighter. But if you always fight groups of five or more, no one expects you to win. And they think you must be pretty tough, or why would you have, you know, that many people have to jump you? And so I was one of those people who walked around with my face beat in all the time. But some people, you know, actually thought I was tough. I never convinced the most important person, of course, that being myself. But anyway, I would stand down on the boardwalk with my gang looking tough, and I'd see some touristy-looking people walk by, and they would look at us, and I would take my cigarette, and I would throw it down on the sidewalk, and I would put it out with my bare feet. And I'd see these touristy people, and they'd kind of whisper back and forth to one another, and I knew what they were saying. They were saying, "Wow, that is one tough broad." And I was very impressed that I was able to do that. I knew they were even more impressed than I was. And again, after I'd been sober for a while, my sponsor explained to me that perhaps what some of those people were saying to one another was, "Did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anyone do anything so stupid?" You know, but I didn't know there was another way of looking at it. You know, I just thought it was very tough. And so I did that all the time. Anyway, I was, you know, in my alcoholic home, there was a lot of the same kind of things that go on in anybody else's alcoholic home. There was a lot of violence. There was a lot of different kinds of abuse, and there was just a lot of that sort of stuff. And so I really just was never, this was never going to be part of my life. And yet, you know, throughout the years, it's been quite interesting. When I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the only person that I hated more than my mother was myself. And I hated my mother, who was the alcoholic in my life, the active one, present anyway. And I hated her for because of so many things, you know, that could go, that had gone wrong and that did. And I blamed her for everything, you know, that had ever gone wrong. And it was a long time in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I began to take some responsibility for some of my own actions. And interestingly enough, I was to learn later on in sobriety that I judged my mother so harshly for her alcoholism and where it took us. And yet, after working the steps and getting to know who I was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I realized, you know, that my mother and my alcoholism were very, very different. See, my mother had some morals. My mother had some pride. My mother had some values. I had none. I only thought of friendship as a way to get in your house so I could steal something from you. That's all it was about for me. And my mother never did those kind of things. And my alcoholism was to take me places that my mother never, ever went. You know, and so the harshness of how I judged her in her alcoholism, I was to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous that that was something that I was going to have to pray about, you know, that forgiveness, both for her and for myself and where my alcoholism had took me. I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mother brought me to a meeting, not because I asked for help, not because I wanted help, not because I wanted to quit drinking, but just because she thought if she left me alone, I might get her evicted from another apartment. And I came into the meeting that night, and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous began for me that night, even though I did not get sober that night. And it began for me because there was a man in that meeting that I admired more than anybody else in the whole world. And I did not admire very many people, but I admired this man. I admired him for a lot of reasons, some of which you may not identify with. He was actually a drinking friend of my mother's. And I admired him because he was one of the most hostile and violent people I had ever known. He had tattoos. He'd been to jail. He rode a motorcycle. He had a knife and carried it with him at the meeting that night. And I looked at him and I thought, wow, I never thought people this tough came to AA. I thought it was just for the weak people like my mom. And it made a very big impression on me. I mean, if I had to tell you what I wanted out of life in one sentence when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wanted the ability to walk into a room full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens, you know. But that was what I wanted out of life. And this guy, Paul, he had achieved everything that I wanted out of life. Because I had seen him walk into bars or parties. And once he'd been drinking, if he wanted to sit at your table, you just gave him the whole table. Because you didn't know what he was going to do to get it, you know. And so I looked at this man who had accomplished every goal that I had. And he was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it made an impression on me. I got drunk the next night. And then I came back to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not raise my hand. I wasn't an alcoholic. And even if I had been, I wouldn't have joined an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. So I went to meetings. In between the meetings, the only person I talked to was Paul. He was the only person of a caliber I felt that I would be willing to talk with. And I explained to Paul that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I was far too young to be an alcoholic, that I had places to go, people to see, things to do, that I wasn't anything like my mother, who was tremendously alcoholic, and that I was therefore completely non-alcoholic. Now, I later learned that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people that they're not alcoholic. You know, they already know that. And Paul turned to me and he said, you know, June, I'm pretty new in this AA thing, and they've told me that I can't diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. He said, I've seen the way that you drink and I've seen the way that you use chemicals. And I happen to believe if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you, within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't making up some horror story like a teacher in high school would about something they didn't know anything about. He was just talking about facts. He was just talking about things that had happened and were beginning to happen in my life. But I did not want to be an alcoholic. I did not think it was that bad. And yet, in that 2-week period of time, every alternative but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. I've already mentioned, you know, how I felt about my mother and how I felt about myself. I was so filled with hate at all times, except for if I had enough alcohol to kind of dilute that. In this 2-week period of time, I attacked my mother, as I had on many occasions. But my mother was getting sober again that time. She'd been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for many, many years at that time. And she was getting sober, and she didn't think she had to be subjected to physical attacks in her apartment. And she asked me to leave, and I did. The rest of my family had not spoken to me in a couple of years. I was not allowed to call. I was not allowed to come by, and I didn't even bother trying. I had been in a lot of foster homes. I'd been thrown out of all of them. None of them would take me back. I tried to get in a couple drug recovery and alcohol recovery homes that were in the L.A. area at that time. There weren't very many, but the ones that were there, none of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. And then I thought, well, you know what? Who cares? Who cares about all that? Who cares about these families, these programs, these homes? None of that really matters. If you're a tough broad, there's only one thing that's important. There's only one thing that counts, and that's your gang. And then one day as I walked down an alley, all five members of my own gang beat me up. And I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a black eye. I had a swollen lip. I had no shoes. Wouldn't have worn them if I'd had them. I had no money. I had no friends. I had no place to stay. I had the clothes that I had on, and I raised my hand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you can see where it was really rather simple. It wasn't like, would you like to go to Hawaii or join AA? I mean, it was just a much easier decision than that, you know. And I raised my hand. I know today that there were some people in those meetings that did not know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous that Terry read tonight, in particular the third tradition, the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And the reason that I know that some of those people did not know about that tradition is because some of those people who knew me through my mother knew how old I was, and they came over to me after the meeting, and they told me that they didn't want a little kid sitting in their meetings while they talked about serious things. And they told me if I came back, they'd get together and throw me out. And I just thought, you know, AA just doesn't want me either. And that's okay with me, because I don't want me either. And I hadn't for as long as I could possibly remember. And so I fell back on my number one answer, the answer I'd been using since I was 5 years old. I went over to a friend of my mother's house. I went into her bathroom. I found the kind of pills that I needed to kill myself, and I took enough of them to do it one more time. And before I passed out that day, I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the time I got to that meeting, I could not stand and I could not sit. I had to lay in the meeting. Now, I don't know about where you guys go to meetings here in Georgia, but where I got sober in West Los Angeles, they almost never call on people to share who are laying in the meeting. But for some reason that day, they did call on me. They realized that I needed to be in a hospital, and that was where I came to next. And a doctor had given me medicine to make me throw up, and a doctor explained to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart, and had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I really can't tell you why that overdose was any different than all the others that I'd inflicted upon myself. I just know that it was. But since that time, one day at a time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. That's how I personally define sobriety. If I continue to do that one day at a time, the 13th of July of this year, I'll celebrate 26 continuous years of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really important to me that you know, especially if you're new, that I never planned on staying here 26 years. You know, if they'd asked me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous if I wanted to go on living or not for 26 years, I would have checked the no box. I'm not one of those people that stayed in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because I was afraid that if I went back out there and drank again, I'd die. Because I tried to die as long and as hard as I could out there. I have always been afraid that I would be one of those people that could go back out there and continue to live the way that I was living. And I'll tell you, by the time I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not have gone on breathing in and out 2 more times, hating myself any more than I did. It was not possible. Now, it's very interesting to me because over the years, people have said things, a number of different things, you know, like, you know, kid, I spilt more booze on my tie than you ever drank. And of course, I explained to them if they hadn't spilt so much, they probably would have gotten sober younger. But I, over the years, a number of people have come up to me and said, you know, you are so lucky to have gotten sober so young. And, you know, I used to get really angry about that because I thought that they were saying that I hadn't suffered, that I hadn't felt my pain, that I hadn't paid my dues. And you know what? Over the years, as I've thought about that, I've realized just how lucky I was and I am. I don't know how many years I was sober, but I was thinking about this tonight. You know, there's a woman from New York, and someone sent me a tape of hers a number of years ago, and her name was Dottie. And, you know, people back home, and I'm sure they say this to you here, they say, you know, you keep going to meetings, and someday you're going to hear your story. And I'm not sure how long ago it was, but it wasn't all that long ago. Maybe 7 or 8 years ago when someone sent me this tape of Dottie. And this was a woman who grew up in Brooklyn in New York. And she lived a life very much like mine. And she hurt a lot of people, just like I did. And then she stayed out there for another 20 years after I did. And I'll tell you, it was the first time I realized how lucky I was that I got to get off the train of alcoholism when I did. Because you know what? My disease doesn't take me to very pretty places. And after I was sober not that long, I would run into people, you know, from where I came from. And I have to tell you that up to and including tonight, I don't know one woman from where I grew up that I used to drink and use with that isn't dead, locked up in an institution, out working the streets so that they can get what they need. A number of my friends have had babies that were born addicted to different substances who've died afterwards. You know, I come from a place where the gas, the phone, and the lights were never all on at the same time. And that's where alcoholism takes people like me. And you know what? I'm not any better than any of these women that I grew up with. I'm not a better person. I'm not a more spiritual person, I don't believe. I'm just a person who has the disease of alcoholism. And I've been fortunate enough to be given the gift of sobriety that I've been given here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And to have met a group of people who've taught me a way to live. Because I didn't know anything about living when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't really even interested in living. But I couldn't die. And so I had to start looking at some options. You know, I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have maintained being very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous throughout the years that I have been here. And I've had to maintain my level of activity or service work in a variety of different ways over the years. But I've been very fortunate that I've been able to do that. And I think it's one of the reasons that I've never felt bored with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've never felt bored with meetings, you know, or with everyone in AA. I certainly can't say I like everyone in AA. I heard someone a long time ago say, you know, if you like everyone in AA, you might not be going to enough meetings. I think that's possible, you know. And nor do I expect everyone in AA to like me, you know, and that's really okay. That's not what it's really all about, you know, I don't think. I came into this program with a horrible attitude. I don't want you to think I got sober and suddenly a bad attitude overcame me. That wasn't true. I came here with the only attitude I had ever had in my life, and it had always been bad. I did not like me. I didn't like my mother. I figured any other alcoholic women around here had to be like one of the two of us, and I didn't want anything to do with them. I didn't want to sit next to women. I didn't want to shake hands with women. I most certainly was not going to hug women, and I did not like listening to women speakers, which is something that always makes me feel better. I know there are never as many people listening to me as it looks like. The only men I had ever known in my life were alcoholics. Most of them were extremely violent. I figured all the men in here were alcoholics, and they probably were like that too. They scared me. I didn't want anything to do with them either. And I had a problem because in July of 1972, when I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, all we had were men and women, and I didn't like any of them. But I went to 21 meetings a week anyway. And I had a very limited vocabulary when I got to the program. It consisted almost solely of profanity. There were a few exceptions. The and mother. And found that there were a number of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who were extremely offended by the type of language that I used, and so I tried to use it more when they got near me. I didn't wear shoes most of the first 2 years that I was sober. I wore motorcycle chains on my wrists and my ankles. I had a motorcycle jacket that on the back said, "Do unto others," and then split. It was kind of my own little spiritual, you know, slogan. And the way I felt about the world. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day. Occasionally someone would hold a match for me, but they never lit my cigarette with it. Sometimes someone would hold a door for me, and I'd let them hold it until they got tired. And when the door closed, I opened it for myself only, and I went through the door. And, you know, that was all about, I just didn't want anyone here thinking that I needed them. Of course, today I know how ridiculous it is. No one who's doing so well all by themselves ever comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I thought that I was fooling people. Most of the time I didn't accept rides to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked. If I had enough money, I took a bus, and if I didn't, I hitchhiked if it was far. And after a little while, I took up smoking cigars and then later a pipe. And if you choose to dress that way and talk that way and act that way and smoke that way, you too can sit in a meeting at least as half as big as this and have an entire row all to yourself. There were a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that stayed away from me, and so I was happy about that. That's kind of what I wanted. You know, it oftentimes seems to me, or it used to seem to me, that people would talk about coming into Alcoholics Anonymous feeling terrible, you know, at a point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, as most of us are when we arrive here. And then they took a 30-day chip. Their family welcomed them back. They became their own best friend. You know, they were one of God's kids, and they kind of lived happily ever after, you know, with God giving them parking places from then on. And I would just think, you know, I'm just, that wasn't the way it was for me. You know, when I got sober, I hated myself more than I had before. And that had a lot to do with why I had to keep you away from me. I didn't take baths or showers after I got sober. I hadn't taken them for a while before either. You know, but some of it had to do with, I didn't have a place to stay where there was a bath or a shower a lot of the time, even after I got sober. Some of it had to do with the fact that I didn't want to touch myself. I felt like throwing up just to try and wash my arm off. You know, there wasn't any question about, you know, I've learned over the years there are makeup wearing and non-makeup wearing tough rods. I was a non-makeup wearing tough rod because I didn't even look in mirrors. There was absolutely no way that I could have stood and looked in a mirror at all. In fact, you know, one of the first things of hope that I remember thinking about in the early weeks of my sobriety was I would hear people talk about coming in here hating themselves and hating everything about their lives and the people that they had, you know, that they had hurt and abused, that there was no way that you could make a reparation for, and I was able to identify with that, and I knew that there were people that I hurt that will never be the same because of the way I walked through their life. And I would sit there and I would listen to them, and they would talk about getting over that self-hatred. And I would sit there and I think, well, it's not going to work that way for me. But maybe one day, if I really work Alcoholics Anonymous 110%, maybe one day when I'm walking down the street and I happen to look in one of those storefront windows, which would be the closest thing to looking in a mirror that might happen for me just by accident, maybe I won't feel like throwing up at what's looking back at me. And that was enough hope to keep me coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, that maybe someday if I caught a reflection of myself, I wouldn't feel like throwing up at what I was and where I'd been and what I'd done, you know. And I kept coming back for that. And I did get very active, and I had a commitment I went to 21 meetings a week most of my first 2 years. I had a commitment at almost every single one of those meetings. My entire life really revolved around being on the way to a meeting, on the way from a meeting, at coffee after a meeting. I mean, I had no life. You know, my family wasn't home waiting for me to come over. You know, I was over 5 years sober before I was invited to a family function in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was very slow. I was over 10 years sober before I got a key to anything in my family, you know. And I earned that, you know. There was a reason for that. But it was just a really long, slow process for me. I have a seventh grade education. I dropped out of school. I never went back, really, after I got to the program. You know, they wanted you to, like, not smoke, wear shoes. You know, I mean, there were all kinds of requirements that I was incapable of. And so I just went to lots of meetings, and I got the kind of job that you can get with a seventh grade education. And I was able to get flexible hours so that I could go to lots and lots of meetings. And, I got a sponsor. And I think getting a sponsor is an incredible necessity. I really strongly recommend it. In fact, I was starting to tell Susan today that this guy spoke at my home group, you know, and he was talking about how he got his sponsor, but he was also saying, you know, if you get a sponsor and they don't make you laugh within the first 15 minutes, get another sponsor. You know, I mean, sponsorship and laughter really go hand in hand a lot of the time, you know, and the ability to learn to laugh at myself has been one of the greatest gifts that I've gotten here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I got to the program, I didn't think anything was funny at all. If it had anything to do with my life, it was not funny, you know, and the freedom that laughter has provided over the years has just been fabulous. I got this sponsor. You know, I was going to 21 meetings a week. It seemed as though a woman named Gail Wilson was talking at about 18 of those meetings every single week, And I thought to myself, you know, maybe if I ask this woman to be my sponsor, I'll be able to find out ahead of time where she's speaking, and I won't have to hear her all the time. And that was what motivated me to get a woman for a sponsor. I mean, I'm still fascinated. You know, it talks about in the book that we are people who normally would not mix. And my sponsor and I, that's exactly, you know, whenever I see that line, I think of my sponsor and I. You know, my sponsor was from the South. She'd grown up in a warm, loving family, which I hated anybody that was like that. She wore pink. You know, I did not wear pink until I was over 10 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it was not allowed, you know. She not only didn't use the same language I was using, she didn't know what a lot of the words I was using meant. And it's just unbelievable to me, you know, that she could have become my sponsor. She would be at, my home group today is the Thursday night Brentwood workshop, and it's a fabulous meeting. That was her home group, and I would go up to her at the Brentwood workshop, and I would shake her hand and say hi, and she'd say, "Now look, June, don't sit next to me at the meeting. I can't take the cigar smoke." And she'd say, "And not only that, please do not tell anyone that I am your sponsor." And that was fine with me because I didn't want anyone to know I was hanging out with someone lame that wore pink, you know. So I didn't tell a lot of people. You know, I was thinking, you know, when Susan and I were spending time together, I was remembering that I met a guy from Georgia at one of my first conventions. And he became a good friend. We've only run into each other a couple times over the many years at different conferences. But what happened for me was I went to this convention with my home group, and I'm sure, you know, you guys have things like this where, you know, 12 people pile in a car for four, you know, so that you can go to a conference. And that was the kind of thing this was, the Monday Night Venice group, and a bunch of us piled into the secretary's car. And I grew up, you know, in Venice. I had run away once, and I made it 6 miles east to a town called Culver City. That was as far as I'd ever been in my life. And when I went to this conference, it was actually my second convention, but when I went to this conference, this was the farthest I'd ever been. It was San Francisco. It was an 8-hour drive from L.A. I had never been that far. And we drove to San Francisco in the car, and I was a little bit less than 1 year sober. And we drove up to this hotel. It's the St. Francis Hotel. I don't know if any of you have ever been there. I have only been back once. But when we drove up, you know, being from an alcoholic family, I lived in a lot of hotels. But none of them looked like the St. Francis Hotel. I had never seen anything like this. You know, we pulled up, and there were these guys, and they were opening the door for you to get out. And I looked inside. You know, there were red velvet drapes, and there were women in there wearing long dresses. It was daytime, for God's sakes, you know. And I could not believe, I wasn't even wearing shoes yet, you know. And when we got to that conference, I stayed in the car. Because I knew that people like me don't go in places like that. I knew that if I walked into that hotel, they were going to come over and they were going to say, "Excuse me, can't you tell this is a nice place? This is for good, decent people. We don't want people like you in here. You're going to have to leave." And I didn't want to embarrass my friends. And after a long time in the car, they finally, you know, came out and convinced me. And I went into the room and I snuck in. It's kind of how I saw it. It's the only convention of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've ever been to. I didn't go to one meeting. I never went. I just didn't feel comfortable being in a place like that. I went down to Skid Row, and I walked around. I felt kind of comfortable, and I felt like I didn't stick out. And that's where I saw a guy wearing a badge. And he was a guy from Georgia. He didn't have that long, much longer than I did. You know, it was an international convention, and I guess he didn't feel all that comfortable in that hotel either. You know, and we kind of talked, and he got me to come back, and we went to a hospitality room, and I met some people. And that was the best I could do. I think it's kind of interesting, you know, after I'd been sober for a while, I got a chance to go to a school that my sponsor wanted me to go to, which was a secretarial college, and learn how to be a secretary. If there's anything in my life I never wanted to be, it was a secretary. It was not even on my list, but it made my sponsor really happy. She thought it was a great idea. So I signed up and I took all these classes and I went to school. I started out typing 17 words a minute with 9 errors. I typed one day at a time for an incredibly long period of time. I don't know if it was a year or whatever. At the end of that time, I was typing something like 35 words a minute with 17 errors. I mean, it was not a good thing, you know. And they said, I'm sorry, but you're not going to make it as a secretary. And I knew that, you know. They said, but you might be able to get some other kind of office job if you'll take a test to give you an equivalent to a high school diploma. And so I studied for this test, and I was able to pass that test. And now I had to go out and look for a job. And I was a couple years sober. I was not wearing shoes regularly. I did not want to go look for a job. It was the hardest thing I had ever had to do up to that point in my sobriety, to go out and look for a job. I felt, you know, like I was going to these citizen-y type places, these offices. And I felt like I had no idea how to dress. I didn't know how to wear makeup. I didn't know how often people wash their hair or brush their teeth. I didn't know any of these things, you know. And I felt really stupid, and some women on the program gave me some clothes, and we went down to like a Salvation Army and we bought me some things, and you know, they showed me how you dress when you want to go look for a job in an office. And to me it was kind of like, you know, look at the little Venice bride in the citizen costume. You know, I just didn't feel like it was working at all, you know, but I kept doing the footwork and filling out these applications and not getting a job, and I just kept showing up. And then one day I got a job. It was in an insurance company. I knew my sponsor was going to be thrilled. And she was. And I worked really hard. And on the seventh day, they called me in. And they said, I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go. They said, you just don't have enough experience. And they said, and not only that, you don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever. Now, I didn't know what common sense was. But I knew I was being insulted. You know? And I went downstairs and I called the Los Angeles Central Office. Because, you know, I'd been sober for a couple of years at that time. I'd been to a lot of meetings, 21 a week. I had never, ever heard of anyone sober in Alcoholics Anonymous being fired. And I didn't think we were going to let things like that happen here. And I reported this company. I figured we would pick it or something. You know, they just laughed and, you know, sent somebody over to pick me up and let me sit at central office all day. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. I remember talking to my sponsor. I said, you know, I never got fired before I came to AA. And my sponsor reminded me I'd never had a job. And those are the kind of things you can only get from a sponsor. You know, you got to have them there to give you that insight, because that hadn't occurred to me. Anyway, I went ahead and I got a woman call me on the program, and she said, there's a bank downtown and they're hiring. Well, I thought that was pretty funny. I'd never even been in a bank in my life. I had been stealing longer than I'd been drinking. Actually, I didn't stop stealing when I got sober. I felt that drinking and stealing were unrelated activities. When I first got sober, you know, they would say it's really important that you get the big book. I never had, I think it was $4, or it was maybe even $5 back then. I don't know. I never had that much money all at once. And so I decided right away, as they mentioned at my home group, that you should do. If you didn't have the book, they said you should steal it if you were, you know, were too afraid to talk to somebody. And I decided right away I would steal it. But I thought if I stole it from an AA meeting, it might jinx my sobriety. And I didn't want to take any chances, so instead I went down to the library and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. While I was there, I stole a copy of the 12 and 12, because I heard a lot of people talking about that book. I thought there might be something good in there, you know. And after I'd been sober for a while, I realized there were these amends steps. I'd been stealing books all through the years. You know, I had great classics like Misty the Seahorse and things like that. And I loaded all these books and I took them down to the local librarian and I returned them to her and I explained to her that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that it was necessary for my sobriety to return those books. And I was wondering if I could make payments, because they wanted 3 to 5 cents a day, and I'd had some of the books for 11 years. And she said that would be fine. She said, I used to work in this library in Laguna Beach, and she said this man came in, he'd had this book for 7 years. She said, I guess you guys do this all the time. And just another time when I realized I wasn't different, you know. But anyway, so this woman gave me a ride. I didn't have a car or anything, and she took me downtown to this bank, and I filled out this application. You know, I got to the part in the application where it says, due to the fact that as a bank employee, it's necessary that you be bonded, we're going to do a thorough background check. And I thought, oh no, not me. I mean, they call one library, and I have had it. You know, I do not want to fill this application out. But I kept thinking about, you know, doing the footwork and leaving the results up to God. And I went ahead and I tried it, and I turned in this application. I got called back on a series of interviews. They not only hired me to work in the bank, they put me to work in the vault. And I didn't even know if AA worked that good, you know. But it did. I didn't steal anything the whole time I worked there. It was unbelievable, you know. Anyway, and after a few years in the program, after that, working at that bank, and I got laid off, and I decided I wanted to, I was taking some classes while I was there, and I took a class they called a dummy English class, because I wasn't able to read anymore by the time I got sober. I guess that doesn't sound quite right. I wasn't able to read. I mean, I could read words, but they didn't make any sense in my mind. I couldn't understand a whole sentence at a time. And so I took this class that they called at the school, a dummy English class, so that maybe I could learn to read again. And I took that, and I took a couple other classes, and I worked full-time until I got laid off at the bank. And eventually I was able to get a job on campus and another job on the weekends, and I started taking more classes. And I just kept showing up. And I filled, after a couple years, about three, I finished all the requirements for what they called an AA college degree. And I thought that was a nice name for a college degree. I never wanted a college degree. It hadn't been on my list, you know, but I was just amazed that AA had allowed me to, you know, to do that. And I went ahead and I graduated from that college, and I went ahead and filled out some applications so that I could continue on this dream that I'd come up with, because my sponsors told me I had to do the footwork for my dreams. And I went ahead and I filled out these applications, and I turned them in, and I got accepted in a university, and I went on to school, and I continued, you know, to work and put myself through through college, and I graduated. And gosh, it's been a really long time ago now still, but I went ahead and filled out some more applications, some more papers to apply for this dream that I had. And I received a telegram, gosh, over 15 years ago now, telling me that I had been chosen as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. Now, I'll tell you, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I always planned on spending a lot of time in court. But never on that side of the table, you know. And as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to show up and go to school. And it was really hard. And it was not too long before this time that I started having some, you know, some breakthroughs. And Susan and I were talking about this. I was at this conference in Palm Springs. And I was very active in that conference. You know, my sponsor had a regular commitment, and so I helped her, you know, in that many times over the years. And one night I was at the Palm Springs Roundup, and it was a fancy banquet, you know. And someone had given me a ticket, and someone had given me a dress to wear. And I was sitting at this conference at a table, and I was comparing myself to everyone else in the room, which I still do sometimes if I want to make myself miserable. And I was wearing this brown dress, and I was looking around, and I thought, ooh, wow. You know, look at that black dress over there. Don't you wish you were wearing that black dress? And I thought, no. I talked to myself. Well, what do you mean, no? You know, it's like, well, no, I like that black dress. It's very pretty. But I think it's great that I'm wearing this brown dress. It's like, all right, wait a minute. How about the green dress? Green is your favorite color. You see the green dress over there? Don't you wish you were wearing that green dress? No. I think it is a beautiful green dress, but I'm really glad I'm just sitting here wearing this brown dress. Like, you are kidding. It's like, no. I thought, all right, don't you want to be blonde or stacked or anything? And I thought, no, I just want to be tall, skinny, have curly red hair, be sitting right here at this table in a brown dress. I couldn't believe it. Now, you might think that's incredible, because I still do. But I'm going to tell you something that is 1,000 times more incredible for someone like me. Because I continue to sit there and ask myself questions. And not wanting to look like anyone else from where I came from, it's a big deal. But I started to ask myself, you know, I didn't even wish I had a different mother. I didn't wish I came from a different family. I didn't wish I wasn't from my neighborhood in Venice. I didn't wish I'd met my dad anymore. I mean, I did in the sense of wishing to meet him, but it wasn't like a big sad thing that I couldn't get through the day, you know, not knowing because my mom had never gotten married. And I just sat there asking myself these questions, you know, kind of like it says in the promises, we will not regret the past. And all of a sudden, something happened that was more incredible than anything else that I can describe to you. Because at that moment, I didn't want to feel like anybody else. Now, I never had that before drinking, while drinking, or after drinking. I always wanted to feel like someone else. I always wished something was different. And that moment in time will stand out in my mind forever. Because when I stayed sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in those early months, I kind of just hoped that maybe someday I might catch a reflection as I walked down a street and not feel like throwing up at what I looked like. And the idea that you could take someone like that to a place where for a moment they didn't want to trade places with anybody else. They didn't want to look like anybody else, but more importantly, for the first time in my life, I didn't want to feel different than I felt. Now, you know, I'd love to say that it's been that way from then to now, but that's not true. There's some days I would rather be blonde or stacked, you know? But most of the time, And the longer I'm sober, the more true it has become. I don't want to trade places, even on my bad days, even with my problems. It's okay. You know, I've gotten to a point where it's gotten me to where I am. That doesn't mean I don't feel sorry for myself. You know, I don't wish I didn't have problems, but I don't want to trade them in the same way that I always did before. You know, I was scheduled to graduate in May of 1983 from law school. And in January of 1983, it became very clear that my sponsor, Gail Wilson, was dying of cancer. And in those last couple of months, I was able to spend a lot of time in the hospital with her. She died in April of 1983. And during those last couple months when I was in the hospital, you know, Gail and I would sit there, and many people came in because she was very sick, nurses and doctors, and, you know, there were people coming in and out all the time. And never did one person come into that room that she didn't stop them and say, "Excuse me, I want you to meet Junie. So Junie's like a daughter to me, and she's going to be an attorney." You know, now this is the same woman who used to say, "Don't sit next to me at the meeting, and don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor." And now she's introducing me to absolute strangers who have no interest whatsoever in meeting me, you know. And we sat there and we talked, and, you know, we talked about what that was all about. And basically, you know, what Gail said to me was that Gail Wilson never believed that June was going to amount to anything. She said, "June, when you asked me to be your sponsor," she said, "I accepted because I've been taught never to say no to an AA request." That's as simple as that. She said, "With your attitude and your background, I knew you were going absolutely nowhere, and I didn't expect anything different. But I had been taught that I had a responsibility in Alcoholics Anonymous not to turn down an AA request." And she said, "And so I agreed to sponsor you." She said, "I remember a couple years later when you called me up and you said, 'Gail, I'm going to take a class over at the local city college at night.'" She said, "I knew you'd never finish." She said, "But I didn't say anything." She said, "I just said, 'Fine.' I didn't tell you you weren't going to do it." She said, "And I can remember after not that many classes, you called up one day and you said, 'Gail, I think I want to be an attorney.'" She said, "I had to force myself not to laugh out loud." And we talked about why Gail never said anything. It wasn't because she believed in June. It was simply because she believed in the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because she had been sober long enough here to see things happen that cannot happen. And so she knew that she didn't have the right to say what could or couldn't happen in anybody's life that was trying to live on a spiritual basis, as I've been being taught here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we had this guy that came through my home group whose name was Catfish. And, his name really probably wasn't Catfish, but possible, I suppose, but it really wasn't. But we called him Catfish. And, you know, I've already mentioned how it felt for me when people asked me to leave meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that weren't aware of the third tradition. And I would expect from someone like me that I would have a much higher level of tolerance for anyone being a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. But when Catfish came into our meetings, he had a wet brain. I mean, he was just gone, you know. And he would sit in the front row of my home group, and he would catch imaginary flies and eat them during the meeting. He would stick straws up his nose. He would pick his leg up. And I mean, he would just do the most disruptive, outrageous, disgusting things that I will not go into elaborate detail about. And I sat there and I thought, why is he here? I mean, you know, he may not even be alcoholic. But if he is, he's got a wet brain. It is doing no good. He is just disrupting my home group, distracting newcomers. He sat in the front row. That was my row, you know. Just drove me crazy. But, you know, I didn't say anything. But I thought a lot of things. A couple years later, I was driving to work, and there at the bus stop, sitting at the bus stop, was Catfish. I tried really hard to make sure he didn't see that I saw him. But I was afraid he may have seen me see him, which meant he would say something to someone at my home group. Meant that they would say that I had driven by someone in my home group that needed a ride. He didn't have any straws in his nose. So I stopped and I gave him a ride. Well, we started, you know, to talk. Turned out his name was Walter. I didn't know he had that name. And Walter started talking to me and he said, "You know, I have a daughter." It's like, "You do? A daughter? Oh my God!" You know, couldn't believe it. So anyway, periodically over the years, you know, I was driving to the same place for work, and once in a while I would see Catfish and I would pick him up, and we'd have these very short conversations, nothing too elaborate. And a couple years later, I was at this Tuesday night Westwood meeting that I attend regularly, and they said, "And tonight We have a cake for 7 years for Walter. And Walter walked up and he had one of these all blue, navy blue jackets and ties, and he had this yellow tie. It was power yellow year, you know. And he sounded like one of my college professors when he stood up and he took his cake, and I would have thrown him out of AA. You know, I'm just so grateful that the old timers in Alcoholics Anonymous kept it simple with a tradition like the third tradition. It says no one can ever throw anyone out of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that has a desire to stop drinking. I want to tell you about one other area real quick, and then I'm going to sit down. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was single. And I suppose today I think, well, if you're 13, you should be single. But I didn't really think that way when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, people were guessing my age at 39 years old. And this past April the 20th, I turned 39 years old. And I'll tell you, I am 1,000 years younger than I was when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not ever think that I would not feel as old as I did back then. You know, it's just unbelievable to me that I'm 39. I just feel fabulous. You know, I mean, it's just unbelievable that I could feel this good, you know, at 39. I mean, I'm just like, I'm a kid. It's fabulous, you know. And I felt so old, I didn't think that would go away. I didn't think I'd get that heavy feeling ever to go away. Anyway, I was single. If you stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're single, I have some bad news for you, at least it was for me, and that is that you may have to date. I hate dating. I've always preferred falling in love. Usually do, you know, on the way to the coffee pot, I fall in love. And then the next night, if he comes to the meeting with another woman, I think he's being unfaithful. You know, and that's kind of how I am. But back in Los Angeles, we have these things called AA dates. I don't know if you have them here in the South, but that's where someone asks you out, and then they take you to a meeting. I mean, where else would you go? And then after the meeting, you go to coffee and you talk about the meeting. And then by the time they take you home, you don't know whether to kiss them goodnight or say the Lord's Prayer. You know. I can remember I was on one of these AA dates. We were at the coffee stage of our date, and this guy said, you know, I really like you. And I said, thanks. He said, I really like you a lot. And I said, thanks. He said, but I like your girlfriend at the next table better. Do you mind if I go sit with her? I thought, well, no, not at all. And he did. And I went home and thought things through, which is why my sponsors have been able to convince me over the years that I have never yet had a problem that has been as bad as my solution for it. So I thought things through. I got up the next morning. I had the only real solution. I went down and I tried to join the United States Air Force. Here, that's it. I'm done. I'm getting out of town, you know. And the Air Force wouldn't take me, and so then I called my sponsor, which is what I recommend to you. If the Air Force won't take you, then you might want to call your sponsor. So anyway, when I was in law school, this guy asked me out, and I didn't really want to go out with him. I mean, he didn't have any tattoos. He'd never been to jail. I didn't really know what we were going to talk about. But eventually, you know, I agreed to go out with this guy. And we hadn't been going out, you know, but like a month, maybe, a little bit less, actually. And he came home with an extra ticket because he's from Chicago. He's the oldest of five boys. And he wanted to take me home to meet his family. And I couldn't help but think, you know, isn't this incredible that when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, no one in my own family would speak to me, talk to me, have anything to do with me for years after I got sober. And now I'm someone that someone else wants to take and introduce to the most important people in their life, you know. And we were to continue to date, and in 1988 we decided to get married. And at my wedding, every member of my family came. Most of them had to pay some kind of money to get there because they lived in different places. Two of my relatives came from another country who had never been in this country to represent my grandparents who had died. You know, and as I walked down, you know, I didn't want to be anybody else. I didn't wish I was marrying anybody else. I didn't wish I was wearing anybody else's dress. You know, I didn't wish I had anybody else's shoes. I did wear shoes. And I shopped for days for those shoes, you know, so it was really fascinating. But anyway, get married. We had a fabulous of wedding, and my husband had wanted to have children. I had never wanted to have children. I really had always hated myself and my childhood and my life so much that I could not even imagine bringing a child into this world. I had a number of surgeries after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous because of the damage that I had done to my body. And when I was a couple years sober, I was 15 years old, and several doctors told me I would have to have a hysterectomy, and it was just a question of waiting until I was 18 when I could sign the paper to do it because of the damage to my body and that I would never have children. So I think part of it was I had just kind of accepted I'm not going to have them, and I don't want them anyway, and I'm not sure which was which, you know, which was the more driving force. But anyway, we decided to try, and it took a while and a number of... I've had a number of miscarriages, but I did have a little baby girl, and she's going to be 7 next Thursday. And about 6 months after she was born, I was not feeling very well, and went to the doctor for a checkup, and they told me I was having another baby, which I thought could not possibly be true. We were supposed to have all this help and things, you know, but we were, and I have another little baby girl. And then in these years, I was invited here another couple of times. I had a couple more miscarriages, and I was not able to come, or I was pregnant at different times when I was invited here. But a year and a half ago, I had my my third little girl, and I have these three fabulous daughters, you know, and it's just absolutely unbelievable, you know. I mean, I must say that sometimes, you know. With my kids, I mean, if I was sponsoring them, I'd have to tell them they have to work with someone else, you know, because they don't listen. It's just unbelievable sometimes, you know. But I have to keep showing up, you know, one day at a time. I want to just share a couple of things about this experience. It talks about, you know, in the book, and there was right, we will be amazed before we are halfway through, and I am absolutely amazed. I have no idea whether I'm halfway through or not, you know, but it's just been absolutely incredible, the things that have happened to me. I mean, I am a person today that I would not have even liked when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and yet I'm happier than I've ever been, and I was never happy, you know, before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, or for a long time afterwards. I just didn't know how to do that, and you've taught me how to find some joy in life, you know. I was, a couple of years ago, we moved, and we had a tree where we lived, and I was very attached to my tree. This was incredibly important to me, you know, this tree. I'd never had a tree. I'd always lived in an apartment. I was living in a house. I had a tree. I wanted this tree, but we couldn't take the tree, and we were moving, and I was in the backyard, and I was crying with my little daughter, and she said, "Mommy, why are you crying?" You know, and I said, "Because, you know, I'm really going to miss this tree." And she said, "Well, Mommy, maybe it's time another family has a chance to have this special tree." And I thought, God, I should probably ask her to be my sponsor, you know. Jeez, you know, where did she get that stuff from? But right around then, it was just a little while before Samantha was getting ready to go to kindergarten. And they had this form that they asked us to fill out, and it's kind of like a memory form that you put in your kid's book. And it's, what's your favorite color? What's your favorite movie? You know, what's your favorite place to go? And then the other thing was, what's the best thing that's ever happened to you? And she said, going to Disneyland. And I said, what's the worst thing that ever happened to you? And she said, I got a boo-boo, and it bled. And I want to thank each and every one of you for making that the worst thing that ever happened to my daughter. Because being an alcoholic, from where I came from, that wouldn't have been what would have been on her list if I hadn't found a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And like Norm Alfie always said, but for the grace of God, people like you, rooms like this, I could have missed it all. Thank you.